This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 117 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, it's a long time that we're doing a show by ourselves.
Back to the pure news episode, and it seems like we have an awful lot of it to talk about.
Well, it has been a couple of weeks, so we've got to chime in on the $1.9 million fine. The FAA expanding the Pathfinder role. Nav Canada seeks jail time for rogue flyers. Seek and avoid standards for the industry. Plus a whole lot more news and listener mail. So I think we should kick this off and let's talk about that $1.9 million fine. Well, while we were out, and last week it was far more important that we do the CBP interview, the FAA threw out a petition for a $1.9 million civil penalty. And our first comment was directly from the FAA. This is against Skypan International, and it was for unauthorized unmanned aircraft operations.
That's right. Skypan International is an aerial photography company, and the FAA says that they conducted 65 unauthorized operations. They said, quote, in some of our most congested airspace and heavily populated cities, violating airspace regulations and various operating rules. Now, these were flights over, I think, David, New York City and Chicago.
They would be two of our most crowded airspaces. Between March 21st of 2012 and December 15th, 2014, without a aircraft airworthiness certificate, a registration number, or a certificate of waiver of authorization, otherwise known as a 333. So 43 of the 65 flights were flown in the New York Class B airspace. Now, for those who don't know, Class B airspace is generally airspace from the surface to 10,000 feet surrounding the nation's busiest airports in terms of airport operations or passenger enplanements. So, yeah, they flew in a hot zone and are being charged with that.
Yeah, this is certainly the largest fine associated with UAS activity that we've ever seen. Skypan has 30 days after receipt of the enforcement letter from the FAA to respond to the agency. The reaction to this is, well, it kind of is all over the map, depending on who you talk to. We see an article in UAS Magazine where Christina Eng, who is the chief operating officer for consulting firm UAS Solutions Group, she says a couple of things. One is that, well, you know, the FAA actions can serve as a warning to the industry.
It was a shot across the bow, in other words. We're not playing any games anymore, and somebody needed to be made an example of. Now, we also know the FAA really doesn't have the ability to enforce this penalty. They're only suggesting it, which is where some of the confusion has come in about this.
Another interesting aspect to this is that Skypan did ultimately receive a Section 333 exemption from the FAA, And what's happened here is that the FAA has reached back prior to that exemption and looked at the activity of Skypan. Another issue raised with this is that what about all the others who have been flying commercially? Maybe not now, but maybe in the past. Why Skypan? What about all the others? It's kind of an interesting question. I mean, I think that in terms of enforcement, a lot of us have said, and a lot of others have said, that you know, the FAA needs to make a few examples, show people that they're serious about this. But this has some, I don't know, interesting kinds of twists to it. One of the interesting things, David, is what Skypan actually says about this on their website. And they have a page where they have a whole list of items that they'd like to make public, I guess, with regards to their feelings about this action by the FAA.
Yeah, the interesting one is Skypan has actually was an aerial photography company before they were using drones. They were flying on helicopters. So they have a background doing this. One of the biggest things they came up with was, quote, Skypan proactively contacted the FAA in 2005, 2008, and 2010 to explore special permitting for its commercial UAS activity. By discussing regulatory and suggested technical parameters with the FAA officials in Illinois, New York, and Washington, D.C., and finally in 2015 was awarded the 333 exemption by the FAA blanket ban on commercial UAS operation. However, they do bring up the fact that there was a blanket ban on commercial UAS operations. So I think the FAA picked these people because of where they were flying, which was Chicago, or more to the point, New York, which is the which is probably the most crowded airspace we have in the country. So
sure,
you had to start somewhere, I guess.
Well, Skypan paints themselves, or describes themselves, I'll say, as a responsible company. As you said, they've been in business a long time, 27 years. The drone, if you will, the UAV photography that they do now is done with a helicopter, not a quadcopter. And they make the point of saying they've got a long-time reputation for safe flights within the RC helicopter industry. These are not fly-by-night, people new to this who have discovered drones and thought they'd create a business. This is an organization that produces really professional quality work. If you look at it at their webpage, it's really some really nice stuff. And they seem to be focused on safety. But the part that kind of causes some difficulty with me is this flights into Class B airspace, and that seems problematic. They do say that all of their flights are over private property, that being the property of their clients, that the helicopters that they use are capable of a safe auto-rotation descent in the case of some kind of a failure. But again, if they are flying in Class B airspace, that's kind of a tough one to kind of talk your way out of, I think.
Yeah, we'll follow up, but they had to start somewhere, you know. And we don't know. The fine hasn't been issued. We haven't seen officially Skypan's response yet. So we're about 14 days into where they issued the notice, so they've got 30 days to respond. So I guess we'll be talking about this for another 2 weeks or so, and then beyond if it goes to legal action. So we'll see. But let's move on to some other FAA news. The FAA, in an agreement with CACI International, are going to evaluate how the company's sensor technology can help detect UASs in the vicinity of airports. Class B airspace. How ironic.
Yes.
The FAA's UAS focus area Pathfinders Initiative are research partnerships with the industry to explore next steps beyond the types of operations disguised, Freudian slip, described in the UAS NPRM. Pretty interesting technology. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, CACI, it's an IT services company. They provide solutions for national security missions and government transformation for intelligence, defense, and federal civilian customers. So they've got a lot of experience in that area. The CACI chief operating officer and president, John Mengucci, says that this agreement provides a proven way to passively detect, identify, and track UAS and their ground-based operators in order to protect airspace from inadvertent or unlawful misuse of drones near U.S. airports. So, again, we see an example of industry coming together with the FAA for a very specific aspect to study this and to see if the technology that CACI can offer anyway has application in and around airports. So interesting to watch and, again, something to follow. You know, David, there's so much new technology going on here in so many different areas, sensors. I mean, it's never ending. It's amazing.
As the professor said on the car ride home, it's not like you guys never have anything to talk about, which is true. What I thought was kind of interesting about the quote was to track UAS and their ground-based operators. So it's interesting. It's not only tracking the actual hardware, but the operators and to be able to locate, which has been a challenge for some of these incursions. They've been able to find the drone, but they haven't been able to find the person flying the drone. But I thought that was kind of interesting that they're trying to define it something that can track down both.
Now, the CEO of NAV Canada, he wants to be able to find the operator of the errant drone, doesn't he, David?
Yeah, it's kind of funny how these stories have flown. We've talked about flying badly into Class B airspace, having the technology to find that person, and now what do? When we catch him? And John Crichton, CEO of NAV Canada, which is equivalent to FAA here in the United States, wants operators who fly illegally to be subject to criminal penalties. Quote, "Why don't we go out and catch a few people?" he said, unquote.
Yeah.
"The problem is what seems to be missing now is enforcement," he explained. "The regulators and the governments have come down really hard on the people they catch violating the rules because it's very, very dangerous. I think it's going to take more than fines. Maybe a little jail time wouldn't hurt. I'm all for that. What about you, Max?"
I suppose. Again, I think that the...
Depending upon the severity.
Depending upon the severity and the circumstances. If, you know, reaching back into the past, as we've seen in our first item, is, I don't know, I'm not sure how much value that has. However, if you're talking about a company that's, you know, wantonly disregarding the safety and the proper operation of commercial drones, then that's, you know, that's something altogether different. It's a lot like the problem with people pointing lasers at airliners. It's a very bad thing. It's a very dangerous thing. It's hard to catch them, but when you do, there again, I'd like to see jail time as well. And we have in a few cases. Similarly with drones, if they're being operated in sort of a similarly irresponsible manner, then I think that warrants a stronger penalty. But
if you're going to do the crime, do the time. We've talked about this, and I'm all for if you catch them and they're flying illegally, it's fines maybe or warnings for the first time, but you know somebody who blatantly does it multiple times maybe needs to go to jail for not that I really want to add additional people for jail time, but with our crowded jail system here, but there's got to be some sort of enforcement, which I think is really the message that Mr. Crichton was saying is, you know, we need to start,
sure,
you know, enough is enough. We need to start doing some setting some standards for enforcement. So, on
speaking of standards,
and how is that for a segue?
Very good. So we see in UAS Vision an article: first interim standards for unmanned aircraft detect and avoid released, and this comes from the RTCA, a special committee. Now, the RTCA is a it's a function really that's chartered by the FAA to operate federal advisory committees. And these committees develop minimum performance standards, and they often form the basis for the FAA prioritizing things or establishing regulatory requirements. RTCA, it's actually, it goes back to 1935 when it was the Radio Technical Commission for Aeronautics, but I think it's just now RTCA because the radio part isn't, you know, very, very current or relevant anymore. But anyway, this this special committee has developed these performance standards, an interim proposal. They don't apply to small UAS. This is only for civil UAVs that are flying to and from Class A controlled airspace, which is above 18,000 feet, under instrument flight rules. So this is the heavy iron, I guess, David. This is the big commercial.
This is like what we were talking about last week on our show about MQ-9s. You know, we're talking large aircraft. We're talking aircraft, not small quadcopters or hexacopters. We're talking aircraft the size of Cessnas.
And the minimum operational performance standards, or MOPS, released here, what do they say? Well, they specify that the sensors to detect other aircraft and also to provide operators on the ground with awareness and guidance with regard to aircraft that are, you know, commingled is with ADS-B, TCAS, and radar. So it's kind of a combination of a variety of technologies there. So, David, I don't have the intestinal fortitude, I think, to dive into the details of the standard. I think I'd leave that to others with more technical expertise in that area.
Isn't that the beauty of show notes? We've actually had standards people on our other show, Airplane Geeks, and it was kind of fascinating. But it was interesting about how these committees get set up, and they come together, and then they give their results, kind of a little bit like our NTSB friends, you know, getting together with all of the evidence and coming up with a recommendation and providing it, in this case, to the FAA. So this committee actually has almost 500 members from government and the industry. So
yeah,
it's the people who do know what they're talking about, we hope. So,
and the final document is scheduled to be released, or plans to be released, sometime in 2016. So we'll look forward to that.
So the next couple of stories are my military geekiness coming out. The first one was a press release from Boeing. A unique-shaped unmanned aerial vehicle goes under test, which was the Joint Wing Body UAS from Boeing. It's kind of, I've liked diamond-winged aircraft for a long time. It's always been lurking out there for transports and refuelers, and Boeing has created a UAV that fits this, which means the tips of the wing go all the way back to the tail, so you get sort of a trapezoidal or a diamond shape where you get four wings connected by a fuselage. I would suggest looking at the show notes, but it's pretty cool technology. One of the other uses for this combined wing is they've wanted to use them as sensor platforms, where the wing becomes the antennas instead of a rotor dome like you would have on an AWACS airplane. It becomes an oversized antenna.
That's interesting.
This is going to be a long-duration surveillance mission aircraft, and that extra wing space gives you lift and provides you a place to put your sensors. So
there's also a video in the Boeing release that shows some early testing of this. This is a rigid wing version being tested. And as I understand it, David, they really plan to have some kind of flexible wings on this thing. It's pretty small. I think it's about 3 meters across, and it's launched from a catapult. And you know what else? I couldn't really find a name for this thing in the Boeing release. I don't know what they call this.
A joined wing body UAS.
They have to have some kind of catchy. The Flying Diamond, there must be some name for this, but
like Icarus.
Like Icarus. Now that's very clever. There's a good one.
Yeah, well, let's talk about DARPA and their Icarus program. Now, for all of those people who don't know who Icarus was, he and his father flew too close to the sun in Greece with their wings made with feathers and wax and melted and then fell into the Ionian Sea. But DARPA's taking that plan, and the whole part of the Icarus part is they'd like to build some drones that, after they do what they're doing, they sort of biodegrade or are degradable so that they're not having to be lugged around by our troops.
Or captured by the other side, who then can reverse engineer the technology. So this is kind of, not a spinoff, but it's preceded by another DARPA program, the Vanishing Programmable Resources Program. VAPR.
Oh, come on. It's Vapor.
Vapor.
You got to give DARPA credit. They come up with the coolest names for
stuff. I love DARPA acronyms. So, well, under the Vapor program, this applies to the electronic systems, and the idea is that they degrade and physically disappear in a controlled, triggerable manner. And again, that's the electronics part of it. But the Icarus project, which is the Inbound Controlled Air Releasable Unrecoverable Systems project. Man, Icarus. It builds on that vapor work that's done previously. And this is, I guess, David, for the whole aircraft.
To quote DARPA, a flock of small, single-use, unpowered delivery vehicles dropped from an aircraft, i.e. C-130, each will literally vanish after landing and delivering food or medical supplies to an isolated village during an epidemic or disaster, which is kind of cool. We've seen a lot of disaster relief where you see the helicopter hovering over the crowds of people who want the food, and the helicopter runs the risk of being attacked by the people, and they can't land. And sometimes when they push out the food out the side, it lands on some of the other people on the ground, hurting them in the process of trying to help them. So this kind of technology is kind of really cool that you've got these flyable drones that you can pre-program to land. And when they hit the ground, they disappear, but they leave what's important, which is the food and the medical supplies, etc. So
interesting. Disposable drones.
So our new favorite governor in UAV Digest is Governor Jerry Brown in California, who for once signed a bill over the last couple of weeks. He's been vetoing bills left and right, but this one, he signed California Bill AB 856, which wasn't a new law, but modified an existing law that says, if you're paparazzi, you can't use a drone to support your paparazziing and spying on the denizens of California, otherwise known as actors, singers, songwriters, etc.
Oh, the rich and famous.
The rich and famous. You know, they don't ever spy on us, do they, Max?
No, but I'm not complaining. So, yeah, no, that's a valid problem that celebrities face. But here again, I'm never a big fan of legislation that targets a technology instead of what the effect of that technology is. So, I mean,
agreed. But in this case, I think Brown is doing the right thing, which is he's modifying an existing law to include UASs. He's not doing a separate law, which the other ones were separate drone-specific laws. In this case, AB 856 changes the definition of what a physical camera or for what the paparazzi is, so that includes UAS. So good for Governor Brown. I can't believe I've said that again on another show, but he's actually taking the right approach. You know, there are laws on the books to support this stuff. We need to enforce those laws and not create new ones.
All right. Well, David, we got piles of feedback from our listeners this past week or so, didn't we?
Yeah, well, you know, you take 2 weeks off, you go to a convention, you interview Customs and Border Protection, and you get piled up on emails. So we have read them all, folks. It's just a matter of we might not have responded, so I apologize. We're usually better than that. But the first one was from Ken. He says, this just happened last night here on Long Island's East End. Basically, a drone crashes and burns in Sag Harbor. A drone was flown into the sides of two buildings on Tuesday night and crashed into a deserted main street and then caught fire. And it's all on video, which is really kind of scary.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing where people see these images of this burning, flaming, smoking multi-rotor that's on the sidewalk in a town in New York. And it's kind of people's worst nightmare. Here again, here's somebody flying in a place that they shouldn't be flying, I would have to say.
I don't know. It's Sag Harbor. It probably was some paparazzi flying their drone.
Oh, dear. I think we actually got this in from several of our listeners, so thanks to all who sent this one in.
And, of course, where there are drones, there are anti-drones. We have a whole class of weapons now that seems to have popped up that are determined to take out the paparazzi UAVs. And the first one was from Tim over in the UK, talking about a anti-UAV defense system, AUDS. Not as cool as the DARPA in acronyms. And it works by covertly jamming the drone signal. But the headline was much better than what that actually was, wasn't it, Max?
The headline, UK firms develop drone freezing ray. There's a lot of stories on this. We heard from a lot of you all on this item. Some of the articles are, well, they kind of use flowery kind of language, exaggerating kind of language, death rays for drones and things like that. And it's just a jamming system that disrupts the communications with the drone, which of course is going to cause problems. We also got an article from Peter, who sends us a similar kind of approach. This one is from Battelle, and they call it the Drone Defender. And it's actually it's like a rifle. It's like a shoulder-mounted rifle, and you aim it at the drone, and it does, similar or maybe even exactly the same thing and disrupts the communication signal with radio waves, another jamming kind of device. So these things are popping up everywhere.
Well, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So, I mean, at least these are, I don't want to say non-lethal, but they're a better technology than taking your shotgun like we've seen and blowing the UAV out of the sky.
Maybe not as much fun, though.
Agreed, but the problem with everything is what comes up must come down. So it's interesting that we have these technologies that are going to disable these drones. But what do we do to protect the people underneath the drones that are disabled? So interesting technology. So we've got drones, we've got guns, we've got drones that are doing reckless. And in California, it seems to be where drone legislation flowers recently. Senator Barbara Boxer has introduced reckless drones flights near restricted airspace, a crime. The measure known as the Safe Drone Act. Anytime a U.S. law starts off with the word safe, I panic.
This would make operating a drone within 2 miles of a restricted airspace a misdemeanor offense. Here again, I wonder, you know, is this a legislative issue or is this a regulatory issue? I'm not sure, but California is certainly very active in terms of drone legislation.
But keep in mind that this is a national legislation.
Yes,
this is
yes.
a U.S. Senate. This is Barbara may be from California, but she is looking to make this. And a lot of this comes from this summer's fire season, where we had issues with people flying drones and our firefighting aircraft weren't able to put out the fires because the drones were operating in the airspace.
And in fact, on that topic, we got an email from Steve. This is from the Sydney Morning Herald. So the folks down under are worried about that same thing as well, David. The annual bushfire season is getting ready to start up. And authorities and firefighters down under, they're concerned about this danger that UAV, people flying drones near bushfires, the danger that poses to large aircraft. So you see some concern down there as well as here in the U.S.
And last but not least, we have this is from the Aviationist. Polish Air Force F-16 collided with drone, and this was sent in by Charles. A mid-air impact whose evidence was discovered by ground crews during the post-flight checks exposed damage to the airframe, protective coating, and to the fuel tank. Now, Polish F-16s are late blocks, and when they say fuel tanks, they have overwing conformal tanks, CFTs. It took the hit on the top of the wing into the conformal fuel tank, the CFT.
Are those armored, David, at all?
They're reinforced, but they really are supposed to be lightweight to support the additional fuel and to not provide a lot of drag like you would get hanging a fuel tank onto the wing. Late block F-16s use them quite often. The Israelis, the Polish, the Greeks all have these Lockheed Martin conformal fuel tanks, which you don't really, unless you know an F-16, can't even really tell they're there. But they are removable, like the F-15s used to have the conformal fuel tanks on their F-15Cs and F-15Es. So interesting. We'll follow this up. It's a bit sensational, but there really wasn't any more information other than it looks like it was a hit. And it did do some damage, but there wasn't anything like they caught the guy or they found pieces of the drone lodged into the, you know, like the last strike that we had, you know, that what they found was feathers lodged in the wing, which proved that it wasn't a UAS.
On the Piper Twin.
On the Piper Twin. But
yeah.
So we'll follow up. David Sensati has got a great website and for military aviation. So I'm sure if something comes up, he'll be on top of it. So,
yeah, theaviationist.com, great website. Well, David, I think that's about all we have time for this episode. So we want to thank all of you for listening to episode 117 of the UAV Digest. As always, find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes are at theuavdigest.com/117.
And of course, you can join the conversation in the social media multiple ways. One is you can join our Twitter feed, which is at UAV Digest. You can become a Facebook friend at facebook.com/UAV Digest. And of course, if you want to reach out to Max and I, you can email us, of course, at feedback@theuavdigest.com or david@theuavdigest.com or max@theuavdigest.com. So you ask, how else can you support the show? Well, the easiest thing for you to do is leave us a review on iTunes. That way other people can find us and we can still bring you great content and a lot of great guests that we've been able to present our reviews on iTunes as a way to encourage guests to come on. Likewise, if you stream us on Stitcher, leave a review. If you really want to tell your friends about the show, you can always get some swag, which is cafepress.com. Or if you'd like to help us, you could leave a tip in the tip jar, as some of our shows say. And that would be become a patron at patreon.com. And of course, all of that, we have links to those pages on our homepage at theuavdigest.com. So with that mouthful, I'll say this. I'm David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.